Yeah, okay. I kind of knew you would know when I heard on the break. Okay, so I'm from like Sligo West Common border, so I haven't read both in Cork before, so I thought I can actually get a couple of yodels out because no one will have ever heard them. So I'm quite nervous, so I actually wrote a list of poems I plan to read, so I might cut it a little bit short if I'm going on too long. Can you tell me if I'm going on too long? So, so I just picked up my new book in the printers in Cork this morning, and it looks so amazing. I'm so excited for it. I'll start with a short. I didn't know what to read, so I'm going to start with a poem I read the other night in Galway, which is here. Okay, so this one is called Militant with Hope, which is a line I wrote in a poem by the poet Anna Kinsby. She wrote a brilliant poem about the suffragette Emily Davison and her return ticket. So I took the line I asked her, so this poem is Militant with Hope, and it's quite short, so I'm going to start with it. The hypocrisies are accumulating in small clusters, in heavy consuming units, cluttering my cosy rooms, half-wild garden, and relationship. I used to have more hope, ferociousness, saw clearly in black and white, strode a straight, bright line, had only derision for people like me, who made good excuses, grew comfortable, and let apathy crawl all over me. These are chapbooks of mine that I did before. This new one looks more like a proper book, but I've done four of these chapbooks, which are I'm going to read this one, which I wrote about 5 years ago, and I haven't read out in ages because I kind of read it a few times at the time. And it's about this robot called Asimo. And when I first wrote the poem 5 years ago, I'd just seen Asimo on like a QI TV program, which I really liked, and was hosted by Brian. And then suddenly this kind of robot guy came out, this robot came out, and it is made to look like humanoid, and it's like 4'3", sounds a bit like Michael Jackson. And I had it out, and I was like, oh, and everybody was just like, oh, it's great, and made me really quite sick. So I wrote this poem afterwards, and since then I've written more poems about the more advanced robots in the last 5 years, but they're a bit too depressing. So I'm going to read this one about Asimo. Asimo on primetime TV. Asimo, performing to adoring sighs, like a communal child. You carried out a tray of drinks, trod down steps, and ran. You danced with the guest, soulless, but everyone agreed you outdid her with your mechanical moves, programmed to seem servile dancing on screen, running across the stage while the audience oozes, delighted, letting themselves play the proud parents. The presenter even called you he. What I see is how fast you can run, and how those hands are so easily swapped for guns and needles for spray or voltage. How long are you going to stay 4'3"? Your dance is the decoy, the wooden horse. They cheer and let you in, suppose you'll be their pet and dance all day carrying trays. Of course, they say you'll do the jobs we don't want, as if a million dollar man like you will ever be wasted cleaning loos or down an aluminium mine or picking over smouldering plastic to find pieces of reusable metal like our children do. Your act is faultless, your cracks invisible. I watch and feel low-level dread, a crawling tension, not just in my head, but tangling around my stomach and chest, and you're hiding something we can't see yet. All these antics for our amusement, like we're fed up with humans who can do what you do, but so much better. Even my toddler dances better than you, because she hears and feels and is moved by music, and it's not a programmed response but a rush in her ears. I hate it, but I ring with fear. Emotions I have, you wouldn't know. I also have imagination, like I find you shut down in the box maybe and smash you with some heavy thing left nearby accidentally. Or clip you and pull out your wires with pliers which I've had the foresight to bring. Or just drive straight into you, goose-stepping down the street in the future when you don't dance anymore. I can feel these things, my pet, and an awful lot more. What is it you do again? When you're not playing the puppet, distracting everyone on primetime TV.
Thank you.
that I moved to like the northwest of Sligo, Roscommon, in 1999. And a guy that I became great friends with when I first moved there was just a really unique person, character. And this is really about him. He used to say Hell's Teeth all the time. He's from all over the world, really, but he used to say Hell's Teeth, so I called it Hell's Teeth. And I called the first chapbook I did Hell's Teeth. Hell's Teeth. His house is sinking, the tin roof crumbling. He was springtime, up on rotten ladders, painting it red. A balancing act, juggling brush, can and glass. I used to sit on cushions outside, looking up, squinting, pouring the drinks, laughing, cautioning him on the treachery of ladders. Now a hedge eats the front of the house. I try not to see it flying past on the road because I can't stop. He isn't belly deep in rushes or chasing pigs. His dog doesn't hear my car coming. There's nothing out of date to drink. No one there since he's been gone every day of the last 10 years. I'm kind of following my list because I'm going to bring it to us. Oh, so this is the book, and I just picked it up this morning. I'm like so happy, it looks so good. The picture is like my friend Helen Chantrell did this beautiful painting of a beech tree, which I have in my mother's house over the dinner table. So I just love the picture. She did a picture of me at back. So. Right, so I just picked this up this morning from Cork, so I'm actually just buzzing. Okay, well that last poem was about my friend's house, which was like, he used to live in a cottage up the road from me in my village in rural Roscommon, down Sligo, with like no electricity and to run water. And so I wrote this one about my house. I read this one about my house, which is just further down the hill, and I came to live in a train station, which the line was closed down in the 60s, so there's a great atmosphere in the house, you can kind of feel the feet of people pacing around, you know, waiting for trains, and where I do most of my writing is in the kind of a room that my partner built, a little room which is on the platform, so you get this real feeling all the time, and you get people visiting sometimes whose parents would have emigrated, or grandparents, and so they actually come to see, well, they come to see the graveyard, and then they always come to see my house because it was usually where they left from. So emigration is a massive thing in the rural west. Anyway, so this is about my house, which is a train station. My house. This was the last look at the land, here where they stood in the wind and waited, looking down the bog, impatient for a plume of steam, blooming along the narrow gauge track, for the doors to open and shut them in on the way to the junction with the big city line. They say they'll be back and don't know yet, it's a lie. Waiting, pacing, lifting cases, hoarding in their eyes the light off the lake, the way the trees sway, and all the softness of hills, birds and sky, carrying their cargo inside. The entirety of life, who they are, into the trembling train and away, far across seas, roads and cities, into new lives, old age and death. For many, here was the last place they left, waiting on this platform for change to come, some giddy, some grieving, and even home. I hope it goes okay, I was just saying, I've got this quite long poem, which I've never read before, and I'm a bit anxious about it for the audience. So it's got four. Anyway. So it's coming out in the magazine, The Stinging Fly. It's coming out in the next week or two in their housing and homelessness issue. And I wrote a really, we were going up with the Hermit Collective to support the Dublin Tenants Association. They were doing kind of anti-evictions. And my friend kind of was like, oh, you should write a poem. And like I was, eviction. Like I've been living in the country for 20 years in the same place. And I thought, Jesus, I had a lot of evictions before moving there in 1999. And then I started to write a list of all the places I lived, and I double-checked them with my mom. don't know, I just started writing. It's basically a list of places I lived in. Shit, the one time. So, if that's okay, I'll read that.
Yeah,
absolutely. Well, I'm a bit anxious about it. Okay. Yeah, it's basically a big long list of places I lived before I moved to the West when I was 22. Notice. There's no memory in me of Brighton Square, the half-house flat my parents shared before the split. Then just a shadow, time trapped like a camera flash, of the garage me and Mum stayed in during transit. More a granny flat, she says, which her school friend kindly lent us. I stayed in my granny's before Brabazon Square, the cold corner of a terrace with too many doors and the ghost only I saw. 29 Little Mary Street, over an army surplus shop beside Slattery's, and I can still see the silhouette of a rat that sat in the bedroom door regularly, and being told to leave when I was seen on the stairs. This was meant to be a student house, meaning no kids. Back to Granny's, then out again. One Ebenezer Terrace, a corner house near the Coon, and in that winter of 82, the snow flowed up to the sky, but I'd started school now, two bus rides away, the first ever educated together, so we had to move. To a different world, the salubrious seaside, 71 Albert Road. We shared the house with one other man, had a back garden with grass like a forest canopy that they were selling. Staying by the sea, 12 Grafton Terrace, the first in a run of basement flats. A four-story red brick beauty of a house with servants' quarters are gloomy, and the thumping of the landlord's family feet across our ceiling was a torment to me. Always wanting to be up there with them, playing, which I often was, until the day of the smashed plates and tears, and then of course we got the 4 weeks' notice and they got divorced. Some winter months in my stepdad's family home while they were away, then a few doors down, another basement, 20A Summerhill Road, where the daughters above loved knocking on our door if it was only me there, and running off laughing whilst forcing their way in, to stare and sneer at my crappy room. And I was terrified of them because, as they made clear, this was their house. Further up the same road, 3A, steep steps down, not a lot of light, and when they were suddenly selling, the auctioneer pushed his way past me into the flat, though I was alone and just 13. Out to the sticks then, 32 Bayview Lawns, a corner house on a strangely suburban estate, and we had it for 2 whole years in my teens. The walk to and from the dark to school was a mile across a harsh, stony beach. Perfect for smoking and self-absorption. We chose to Four Longford Terrace, nice flat with a view of the sea, but the landlord had a daughter who needed a place more than we did. Out of home, 27 Lower Drumcondra Road, under the railway tracks. The bottom floor of a rotten house that we affectionately called the pit. And while we were all dancing one morning, the prefab flat in the back burnt down gloriously. And later the landlord collected his insurance, that tenant, by good fortune, being put out just beforehand. And around then I fell on my head. I stayed in the matter, followed by appointments, more appointments, and an ambulance chaser. And so though sometimes one eye looked back bigger than the other, the claim was in, and everyone grew impatient in anticipation of the payout. Black mould over the bed, no heating, no hot water. Seven of us paid rent there for another year more. 8 North Frederick Street, a two-room flat at the back with bars on the windows and a shower in the bedroom. 3 of us in it until the landlord spotted my bump. And 8 months pregnant, he called round to give me 4 weeks' notice. This place was not suitable for children, he said kindly. And him and his muscular son, with the sun in his pocket, stood over me while I scrubbed at the carpet, trying to get the stains out that he said it cost me my deposit, and I scrubbed with that belly nearly touching the floor for £400 and still didn't get it. Carrying black sacks of our lives up the road, after finally a flat in the takers, and when I went for the rent allowance, they wouldn't allow it. This place too was unsuitable, they say calmly, but I'm hysterical. All the way back there to pack up again, almost on the due date and with no idea where we were going. But someone was moving out from a nice corner house, 27 Primrose Street, and she had a kid too, so it would be cool, and for a while it was, but the mould soon grew in the wall, gas heating we couldn't afford to use, but the glass coals looked nice with the light on behind them, and we had problems that had nothing to do with walls. So before the end of that 4 weeks' notice, a skip appeared with the last of our stuff thrown in it while we were out. The locks changed, and I wept for weeks over a Moses basket I wanted to keep. More fortunate than many, my son and I were offered back out to the seaside by my mother and husband and stayed over a year in their two-bedroom flat. His father soon becoming my ex, That same night, leaving the couch he was surfing to sleep on the streets, in and around Stephen's Green mostly. So we go in nearly every day in the dark to see him and to see him decay. Pushing the pushchair with dread up the road, craning to get a sight of him first, to wave, wait till he got up off the cardboard at least, before the pushchair got closer. Then one day, we're walking along, nearing another man curled up in the doorway, and my two-year-old boy calls out with joy, "There's Daddy!" I'm coming back to that flat, 12 Eaton Park, best yet. Bay windows and the rent bars I notice, just an incredible, lonely view of the sea. And then my money came through, the head injury paid off, and we moved on into the West. And it took years to learn we can paint the walls, put up shelves, pictures, or take them down, grow food, shift things around, that it's allowed. No one is coming to throw us out. So my children don't know what it's like yet to move, the insecure, to not know where you're going to be or for how long, to keep everything always half unpacked, that I will never forget. Close enough, I lift up the rough cloth of my hedges, fields, and locks, wrap its patchwork cloak around you, gather the lush green foams and rows of sequin blues to make an earth cocoon for you to grow in. Because when you're rested and ready to stir, it will be my pleasure to watch your wings unfold, unfurl in my cloud-thick hair, sprout your new roots feet deep into my lungs and feed me your fresh air. Kind of following on, I'm going to read this one, which I was just saying to Barbara, I just put in the book, I just wrote it recently, but I'm well aware that it is basically a big rip-off of a lot of other poems that I love, so it's kind of like when you write a song and then you realise it's in the same tune of the songs you love. But it comes from the heart. It's basically coming from the point of view of the mayor of Ballygreen Green in Roscommon, and the best thing that happened to Ballygreen has been the arrival of a lot of new people to the area, mostly from Syria. And so with the best will in the world, a lot of maybe Irish and English people can be a bit... Anyway, I would say. So this is really a viewpoint of some of my new neighbours. And this completely ripping off a lot of other poets. I am not your pet. I am not your pet, your good deed, your project. I'm here because I survived a journey I hope you never know what it's like to make. So I'm not your photo op, your insider gossip, or your interview talk. And no, I don't have the same dreams, skills, or beliefs as my friend in the room next door, or any of my neighbours down the hall, because we are all unique. I'm not a good news story. You can't measure me in column inches, headlines, or sound bites. I am 3D, a real human being, a person of depth, with history, interests, and ambition. I am not your funding opportunity, free ticket, or something to look good on your CV. You don't need to know what's best for me. I am not your pet. I'm waiting to see if I'm going on to them.
No,
okay. This one is self-explanatory. I read it recently in Dublin. There was no funeral. There was no funeral in the bathroom when her first one born slipped into the toilet unnoticed. So when, 10 days later, still doubled over, she was sent for the scan to confirm she was clean, nothing left to be infectious, and a nurse snarled the accusation, "There's no baby here," as if she was pretending to be pregnant, there were to be no condolences. There was no funeral in the bathroom the second time when she had already live children to care for. And though the ambiguous 12-week-old fetus was leaving her desolate, there wasn't a suggestion of bereavement counselling or call for a priest, just painkillers and an awkward handful of tissues on the way back out the door. There was no funeral in the bathroom the third time when it had been her decision, just a secret ceremony of her own, blessing the first specks of it the day after taking the pills. And it is possible to be both grieving and relieved, knowing that this loss was no worse than the others, where no one came to sympathise either or judge. I'm waiting for the song.
You've got another 10 minutes.
Yeah, you've got one. Well, I suppose five, ten minutes.
Whatever suits you. I think time is different over here. Sorry. Well, I'll read maybe two more.
That's grand. Yeah, perfect.
This one was in the Bogman's canon. When I grow up, I want to be nobody. I want to say all the same things as the people around me. I want to believe whatever everyone else believes, and be happy enough with the way things are, however they are. When I grow up, I want to be fashionable. I want to throw away my clothes every season and wear what's new. I don't want to think about who makes the clothes, or how young, or exhausted, or mistreated they are. I want to be cool. I want to upgrade my phone just when I get used to it. I want to drive a new car, or at least have a new number plate. I do not want to look like some weirdo in an old banger, wringing our hands about aluminium mines and the oil industry. I want to just drive. When I grow up, I will not age. I want to own shelves and shelves of cosmetics, all tried and tested on rabbits and pigs, just so I'm sure it will work on me. I'll hide behind a skin-toned wall and paint on the mask, whatever weighs the way at the time, so no one would know I was somebody different. I want to be them. When I grow up, I want a house you could eat your dinner off, the kind you walk straight out of and no one would know you'd ever lived there. I don't want any books on the walls blocking my annual catalogue paint job, and I'll be so busy tidying I won't notice the day passing or the years. When I grow up, I want to be married to someone presentable. I want to wear a diamond ring and be proud of those children who waded in mud 12 hours a day mining and dug with huge shovels and blood and gunshots just to make my ring possible. When I grow up, I want to go to McDonald's or KFC or wherever. I don't want to be a bleeding heart, animal lover, tree-hugging nutter. I want to eat shit. When I grow up, I want to sit on the fence. I'll never argue or make a scene. I won't be protesting warplanes or boycotting Israel. That stuff is for loonies. We still think little children are worth more than money. I won't complain. When I grow up, I won't think about things too much. I will look blank if anyone tries making me care. I'll not be drawn into some emotional reaction over the earth. I will be detached. When I grow up, I want to understand why the economy is more important than water, why fracking companies can tell all those lies, but I want to believe them, and when I grow up, they will be right. I want to live a long life with no scandals. I want people to say over my grave that I was decent. Never made any trouble or a show of myself, but I kept things nice. I want them to walk away talking about something else already. I want to fade from memory, to have made no waves. I want to be nobody, nobody special. It's a bit, it makes me kind of embarrassed if she reads in the book. It's just recently with making a total success in my house because I won a competition involving chocolate, and one of the prizes was the family going to the chocolate factory. And they were literally like, oh my god, that's so brilliant. And they never, like, it was a themed kind of competition with coffee and chocolate. And so I wrote a poem about coffee, which is great loves and more. But it gets a bit steamy. Okay, meet me for coffee. Meet me for coffee. Not a cup of tea, a pint, or just meet me. Because I want to wait awkward at a counter beside you, with the steam spluttering, the espresso machine knocking, and our overdressed elbows almost touching. I want to sit opposite you at a small table that can never be small enough, absorbing the heat of your hidden knees and then eyes when I catch you, watching me lick the froth off my lips. I want us to be both fiddling with our round white cups, thumbing the holes that make the handles, intense with conversation while idling our fingers around and around those curves. I want to be alone with you in a clamorous place where no one will notice what's not being said. That's why I say safely, meet me for coffee, instead of suggesting something else.